I must confess right in the very beginning that this certainly put me through my paces to get ready for the seminar, but it was a subject that I've been grappling with myself. And quite honestly, what led me to do a seminar on this was the fact that I had been in the U.S. for a few months visiting churches that support us while we work as church planners here in South Africa. And everywhere I went, that's all we heard was global warming, global warming, global warming. All of the newspapers, two or three articles every single day. And I got so sick and tired of it, I finally decided, you know what, I'm going to study this on my own. I'm not going to let anybody influence me. I'm going to go and look at the different sides of the issue, and I'm going to find out what's really going on here. And so as I began to do that, and as I began to surf the net and spend long hours, wee into the hours of the morning, surfing the net, finding articles and links and all of that, I started coming to some very interesting conclusions. And so I contacted Joel and asked him if I could possibly do a seminar on this. And he said, no, well, by all means, we'd like you to do it as long as it's not something that's sensational in nature. So I must confess, this is not meant to be sensational. It is meant to be informational for us so that we as Christians can know how we should actually be viewing this whole issue of global warming, because quite frankly, it is not going to go away. You are going to read about it in the press every single solitary day. You're going to hear terms like climate change. You're going to hear carbon emissions. You're going to hear all manner of speak about this. And there are going to be all kinds of legislation that is about to be passed based on the UN's Intergovernmental Panel of Climate Change. I'll talk more about that in just a moment. But you can't escape it. And so I thought, well, let's do something about it. Let's view it from a Christian viewpoint. Not that the Bible talks about climate warming or global warming. I don't want you to get the wrong impression here. But certainly the Bible does talk about our responsibility as stewards of the environment and of the creation that God himself has made. And so I'll look at that at the very end. So I'll have to watch my time here. Let me take my watch off just so that I don't go over time. You know what it means when a Baptist minister puts his watch in the pulpit like this, don't you? It means nothing. So I'll do my best. Well, some of the headlines that I got just off of local press here in Cape Town: World faces 5-year deadline. Another one: most dangerous crisis, says Al Gore. That ought to get your attention. Arctic sea ice near record low. What they don't tell you is that is the North Pole, not the South Pole. Because in Antarctica, the ice mass is actually increasing. So they don't tell you that. Another headline: drive for ethanol poses risks. You know what they found out? You know why corn prices are going through the roof? It's because in America, all of the corn farmers are selling their corn to those factories that make ethanol. And so what it's done is it started what are called the tortilla wars down in Mexico, because it's driven the price of corn through the roof. It's even impacted South Africa and the dairy farming industry, because the dairy farms now can't afford to buy the corn because all the corn farmers are selling to the ethanol industry. And then they've also found out recently that ethanol may actually be worse for us than the emissions from petrol. So the verdict's still out on that. Global warming prospects dire for Africa. Greenland's melting ice spells doom. Sudden sea surges threaten 1 billion. World can expect new climate zones. We heard about that. Wine farmers are going to have to move. They're going to have to move east. They're going to have to set up shop in places like George and Nisna now. Another headline: low-carbon diet aims to take the bite out of global warming. Change your diet to a low-carbon emission diet, they're telling us. Here's another one: future looks bleak for Cape of Good Hope. In fact, I was out at the Cape of Good Hope about a month ago, and as you go out there, there's a little building as you come down from the lighthouse there, and you go into this building, and it's almost like a shrine to global warming. And I just shook my head and smiled, and my kids were tugging on my shirt saying, Dad, look what they're saying. So here's another one other one. Tourists cause global warming. So and that was here in South Africa. That was on News 24 on the internet. And what they're saying is maybe we need to rethink the whole tourist industry here in South Africa. Now, I doubt our government's going to jump on that bandwagon here. So what is all of this about? Well, let me say this right up front. All the scientists, climatologists, when I speak of scientists, I'm speaking of climatologists, geophysicists, oceanographers, meteorologists, and the like that are in the field of studying these types of things, all of them agree on one thing. They all agree that the Earth has warmed by 0.67 degrees Celsius or 1.2 degrees Fahrenheit. Where the area of disagreement comes is on the interpretation of what that means. Why is this happening? Well, my thesis is really quite simple, and I'll state it up front, and it's simply this. We are now allowing subjectively based science with religious overtones and roots in the New Age movement, specifically pantheism, to emotionally interpret the data for political gain and advantage. And I'll develop that more in just a few moments. So let me just look at a couple of items. I wrote down 10 here. I'm not going to have time for all 10, but at least you get the idea. Point number one there, anthropogenic global warming. That just means man-made or man-centered. Man-made global warming hype. Let's just look at the other side of the coin. This is a side of the coin that you're probably not going to read very much about in the popular mainstream media. Now, here's the first point, is the little climatic optimum. Has anybody here heard of the little climatic optimum or the LCO? Nobody, okay. That means the media is not doing a very good job about telling you what has happened in past history. And I believe that the LCO, or little climatic optimum, is actually a good gauge for us to go by as we look at a warmer planet in the future. And the LCO, I'll just call it the LCO for short, started in about 1000 AD, extended to about 1300, 1400 AD. And during that period of time, at least in the Northern Hemisphere as we know, the temperatures were 1 to 3 degrees warmer than what they currently are. And in fact, in places like the Midlands and England and up into Scotland, they produce crops there that can no longer be grown today because it's too cold and the growing season just isn't long enough. During that period of time in Europe, famine and plague was drastically reduced in Western Europe as a result of this. And people were, by and large, much healthier. It was during this period of time that the Vikings started their North Transatlantic adventures, and they went to places like Greenland and Iceland and even Nova Scotia in Canada. And when they arrived in Greenland and they arrived in Iceland, do you know what they found there? They found grapes. You can't possibly grow grapes in Greenland or Iceland today because the climate is far too cold. And so this spawned a whole agricultural revolution. Because they had longer growing seasons. And it was during this period of time that the population in Europe almost tripled from 27 million people to about 70 million people. So we know they were much healthier, and mortality rates weren't what they were during the medieval times. J.R. Dunn, who writes for AmericanThinker.com, said, "The LCO suggests that a warmer world may well be more desirable than the one we now have. To go a step further, my research implied that the planet is in fact meant to be somewhat warmer than it is today." Reed Bryson, who is 86 years old, and he's known as the godfather of modern-day climatology in America. In fact, he was one of the first PhDs in climatology in America at the turn of the last century, said, this. He's commented on some surprising findings from the receding glaciers in the Alps. He said, "What do they find when the ice sheets retreat in the Alps? A silver mine." The guys had stacked up their tools because they were going to be back the next spring to mine more silver, only the snow never went. There used to be less ice than now. It's just getting back to normal. Now, why don't we hear that? Why doesn't somebody in the media do a story on that instead of running around like Chicken Little saying, "The sky is falling, the sky is falling, you better pack your bags and you better get out your flotation devices." But they don't do that. Secondly, in line with the LCO is the Little Ice Age. Well, after the little climatic optimum, what happened is what was called the Little Ice Age. And this replaced the LCO, and this lasted from 1400 to about 1850 or 1880. And during this period of time, things were much cooler. In fact, during the Little Ice Age, people used to be able to ice skate on the Thames River in London, which is something that I understand cannot be done today. At least it would be very out of the normal, but it was normal during this period of time. And there was also an increase in volcanism or volcanoes. There was less sunspot activity, which helped produce a cooler climate. And so since the 1850s, 1860s, the Earth has actually been warming up. And it's gotten to the point where it is today. We're coming out of the Little Ice Age. And so what we're actually seem to be doing is going back to a situation that would be more in tune with the little climatic optimum of that medieval age from 1000 to 1300 AD. And so we will see a modest rise in sea levels, but I don't believe that we are going to see anything on the scale predicted by doomsdayers like Al Gore. So, and just to let you know, I do have a copy of Al Gore's book. I thought if somebody's going to speak publicly on this, they better say, "I've read the book, I've got the book," and quite frankly, as I thumb through it here, it's nothing but a picture book. There's no bibliography in here, there's nothing that attributes it to any scholarly source whatsoever. Now, I'm not a scholar, but you know what, I've read enough scholarly literature over the years to know this is not a piece of scholarship. This is a pretty little picture book. So, and this is what's being used, this is what's being quoted, and I sit back and I laugh. Let me give you another quick one here. Let's look at the CO2 1.3 on your outline. The cause or the effect? I ask the question. The increase in carbon dioxide, what is producing it? Is it man-made or not? Did you know that only 2% of the carbon emission in the atmosphere today is produced by man? In fact, man could actually double what we're currently emitting in carbon dioxide, and it would only raise the temperature of the Earth about 1 degree. That is not commonly reported. Now, there is an area of great disagreement amongst the scientists on the levels of CO2 in the atmosphere. It seems to be a very hard thing to put a gauge on and to accurately measure. But what the scientific studies that are being used by those like Al Gore are actually filled with inherent weaknesses. And I'll just talk about that. Let me read some of the climatologists instead of trying to speak on it myself, because I am not a scientist, and I understand that. But Dr. Roy Spencer, he's a climatologist from America. He is a research fellow at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. He used to work for NASA. The reason he no longer works for NASA is because he said they were too politically motivated in the area of climatology, and they were making decisions based on the trail of money rather than on the data from science. This is what he says about CO2. In the atmosphere. Based upon the available evidence, the current consensus of opinion is that the temperature changes preceded the carbon dioxide changes by more than a century or more. temperature changes causing carbon dioxide changes might be explained by the fact that warmer water cannot hold as much carbon dioxide, so periods of climatic warming led to a slow release of oceanic CO2. What he's saying is the temperature increased first, not the other way around. It isn't the CO2 that's causing the increase in temperature, but rather the temperature's warming up. We're coming out of the little ice age. As a result of that, the seas warm up some, and as a result of that, you have higher degrees of evaporation. Well, the ocean gives off over 95% of our CO2 in the atmosphere. So it makes sense that the warmer it gets, the more evaporation takes place and the higher levels of CO2 you're going to have in the atmosphere. Dr. Larry Vardaman from the Institute of Creation Research in San Diego, California, who is a climatologist, says, does the rise in CO2 result in increased warming of the atmosphere? The greatest rate of estimated warming does not seem to coincide with the period of greatest increase in atmospheric CO2. Again, he's saying the same thing. The water warmed up first, and then we saw higher concentrations of CO2. And there are many others who quote something similar to that. A European scientist by the name of Ernst Beck said this, that actually, during 1936 through 1944, there were actually higher levels of CO2 in the atmosphere than there are today. Well, what happened during that period of time? World War II. That could have been part of the cause of all of this. But he said, currently, there are, in the atmosphere, 380 parts per million of CO2. As opposed to 1936 through 1944, when they had 393 parts per million to 454 parts per million. And so we're not actually exceeding past precedents on some of this. So why all of the disparity? Why the incongruities on CO2 levels in the atmosphere? Let me just quote a couple more climatologists and I'll move on here. But basically, it all boils down to computer-generated models that overemphasize CO2. And as Reed Bryson said, and fail to account for the effects of clouds or water vapor. Meaning they're not accounting for the increase on the base of evaporated water. They're not factoring that in to their computer-generated models. Reed Bryson goes on to say, and remember, he's a weatherman. He helped write the book on modern-day weather. He said, do you believe the five-day forecast? His point is, if you don't believe the five-day forecast, why on earth would you believe a forecast that projects 100 years into the future? And he's absolutely right. And Dr. Michael Ord of Creation Ministries International said, these CO2 model simulations are based on estimates and assumptions, and not exact figures. Unfortunately, many politicians and environmentalists take such imperfect climate simulations and claim them to be fact. So, you can't believe everything you read. At the end of the day, what they're saying is, hey, we're not 100% sure, but the bottom line is, we don't think the sky is falling. 1.4 polar... Okay. Polar bear pandemonium. You've all seen the pictures of the poor polar bears stranded on an ice floe. The point being that the ice cap is going to melt and these polar bears aren't going to be able to swim to shore. Al Gore even puts that in his movie, An Inconvenient Truth. What you may not know is that section of the movie was computer generated. It was not a true picture. The bottom line is, don't worry about the polar bears. They can swim for many, many miles. That's how they catch seals. That's how they live. And their numbers are actually on the increase. In Canada today, there are 3 times more polar bears than there were 20 years ago. And I believe there are 25,000 of them now globally. And one of the reasons for their demise in numbers was due to being hunted from the Inuit Indians and Eskimos. And so they've now put restrictions on that. The polar bears are now coming back. But they use those pictures to evoke images, especially in the minds of our little ones. 1.5, right there, just the point is the total eclipse of the sun. Why doesn't anybody actually talk about the fact that maybe increased sunspot activity might have something to do with this? What I've found interesting is I've pulled down 3 or 4 articles on Mars, and do you know Mars is actually heating up as well? Then I pulled an article down 2 weeks ago that said now Neptune is actually has an increase in temperature as well. I don't think it's our man-made CO2 carbon emissions that's causing the increase in temperature on either Mars or Neptune. But it could well be the sun, and NASA even admits that yes, it is the sun. It is increased solar activity. Well, if they're warming up because of increased solar activity, why wouldn't the Earth be warming up because of increased solar activity? And so I think that's got to be factored into all of this as well. 1.6, what about the scientific hype and hysteria from the recent past? Mark Twain, the great literature writer of the 1800s in America, once said, "I've seen a heap of trouble in my life, and most of it never came to pass." I think of my own life, and I wrote a letter to, I can't remember if it was the Argus or Cape Times. I write so many letters, I can't remember where I've sent them sometimes. It's just a hobby of mine. But I wrote one about Chicken Little. And it was about the fact that since I was a boy, in 1966, I remember when Paul Ehrlich came out with a book on population control. And he said, look, we've got to act now. We've got to curb the population in America, or by the mid-1980s, 60 to 80 million people are going to starve. Well, it didn't happen. After that, in the early 70s, it was acid rain. We are going to be decimated by acid rain. It's going to eat through our flesh. It's going to destroy our crops, all of our vegetation. We've got to do something about acid rain. 4 or 5 years later, by the time I reached high school, the big scare was actually global cooling, not global warming. Let me read a quote from Lowell Pont in a book called The Cooling that was written in 1978. We simply cannot afford to gamble. By ignoring it, we cannot risk inaction. Does that sound familiar? These scientists who say we are merely entering a period of climatic instability are acting irresponsibly. The indications that our climate can soon change for the worse are too strong to be reasonably ignored. We have got to act now, he said. We have got to stave off this decline in towards global cooling, was his point. None of it's come to pass. After that, we've had so many things that have gone on. It was ozone depletion. After ozone depletion, it was Y2K. And now we're on the global warming kick. There in your outline in 1.7, the truth about decarbonization, there's been a big push on that. You're going to see a lot of legislation that's related to decarbonization, getting away from CO2 emission. Let me just say this on this point. This is all in an effort to curb greenhouse gases. Many industries have actually been moving toward this themselves without any governmental legislation, without any lawyers, without any activists. But here's something to consider. Wood contains 10 carbon atoms to every one hydrogen atom. That means burning wood is not a very efficient thing. It's not good for the environment. Whereas coal has a 2-to-1 carbon-hydrogen ratio, and oil has a 1 carbon ratio to every 2 hydrogen atoms ratio, natural gas, 1 carbon to 4 hydrogen. And so, which gives us more CO2? Wood. What happens in the third world? A lot of people burn wood. don't they? And in fact, in South Africa, what happens is we have one of the highest soil erosion rates in the world. Why? Because people in rural areas go out, they hack down the trees, and they don't replace the trees, so the rains come and washes the soil out to sea. So what's giving off more carbon? Your car or the guy who's burning a stove filled with wood. And we just don't hear much about that. So 1.8, the problem with complex systems and computer-generated models. Let me just say this. This is what they call a complex system, climatology. It's not easy. And by that, it means there are many, many elements that make up climatology that must be factored in. There are so many elements, in fact, that there are any number of given variables. A great example of a complex system would be the financial markets. The only one who can really make money for sure at the end of the day is the inside trader. That's an example of a complex system. Your church is an example of a complex system because you never know what's going to happen. There are so many variables taking place. Well, when you start considering the climate and you start considering global warming, here are some things you have to factor in. Solar flux, meaning the sun. Gravity. Barometric pressure. Temperature, density, humidity, the rotation of the earth, the sea's currents, greenhouse gases, CO2 dissolved in the oceans, among other variables. All of this has to be included in your computer-generated climate change model in order to get somewhat of an estimate of what's going to happen. Dr. Michael Crichton of Jurassic Park fame, he is a medical doctor trained at Harvard University, said, "Whenever we think we understand complex systems like climate change, we learn we don't, and sometimes spectacularly." This has been ignored. Nobody's talking about this. Then another argument is consensus. Everybody here has heard there is a scientific consensus about this. All the scientists agree. Is that right? Do all of the scientists agree? And my question is this. I mean, I took science in high school. I had to take a couple of courses in college, at university. And I learned this about science. Science is never determined by a consensus. And there are many examples to prove that we won't go into. But again, Michael Crichton says this, consensus is invoked only in situations where the science is not solid enough. Nobody says the consensus of scientists agree that E equals MC2 squared. Nobody says the consensus is that the sun is 93 million miles away. It would never occur to anyone to speak that way. And so he makes the point. Another study that I read was signed by 20,000 scientists who all disagree with the popular notion of man-made global warming. And nearly 3,000 of those 20,000 were scientists that are actually in the field. Before I did this study and started preparing for the seminar, I contacted a friend of mine in Los Angeles who is a PhD in astrophysics. He works for a subsidiary of NASA there in Southern California. And I said, "Brian, I'm going to study this. Could you give me some help?" And this is what I know about it. And he wrote back and he said, "Mark, I just want you to know that you already know more about global warming than I do as an astrophysicist." He said, "The bottom line is all of the people that they're relying on are not in the field of climatology." And he said, "You know how much they know about global warming?" He said, "About this much. Very, very little." And so we shouldn't be bullied into this notion that the democratic masses amongst scientists agree with man-made global warming. Now, final point here under point one is, what about counting the costs? What are the economic realities of this? This is one of the arguments that's marshaled. The poor are going to get poorer if we don't act on this and curb our carbon emission. The point being that if we don't act, what's going to happen is we're going to see more drought. What happens when you have more drought? You have more famine. And who's going to be the hardest hit? Africa. That is what is being marshaled. And they say, we see it happening already. Historically speaking, according to climatologists, Africa is not currently experiencing any worse drought than what they have in the last 100 years. In fact, Dr. Roy Spencer from the University of Alabama again says this is a problem with Africa. He said African drought does not seem to have yet become that frequent over the last 100 years, despite a modest amount of warming over that period. He goes on to say, Africa's real problem resides in governmental-controlled economies of much of Africa, a lack of personal property rights, free markets, and free trade between countries will continue to make Africa sensitive to the whims of Mother Nature with or without the help of mankind. Bottom line is, many communities have experienced drought and have survived without starving to death. Africa has some very unique problems which make it susceptible to starving on their own without any help from Mother Nature whatsoever. So what's going to happen here? Well, I believe that we are going to be taxed and that we are going to be levied into the veritable Stone Age in the near future as governments begin to cash in on the drama that's being forecast. In fact, just a week and a half ago in the papers, the government was saying, look, we're going to have to put a 30% tax on SUVs and on sports cars. And you see, government's already beginning to wring its hands. This is a cash cow. As they can start taxing all manner of luxury items and factories and businesses and industry so that they can get more money. This is one of the reasons why governments are jumping on board. Now, it's all fine and well. We could go into more of the science. I don't want to do that, because I want us to look more seriously at why are we hearing so much about this. I'm not a scientist. I don't want to stand here for an hour and talk about the science of this. What really interests me in this whole thing is why. Why now? Why are we hearing so much about man-made global warming? There must be some motivation. There must be some base cause. And that's what really interests me in all of this. The thinking behind the thinking. And number two, pantheism. I believe this is a predicate and a catalyst for man-made global warming. And this is what is actually promoting so much of this. Now, I believe there are actually two pillars that are streams of thought that are influencing this. The one is on the political side. And I believe that you have many liberal politicians, especially those of a socialistic framework, who are very disappointed that their great social experiment from the 1900s didn't work out too well and that the Berlin Wall fell. Now they are no longer Marxists, but they are neo-Marxists. And they still want big government. They still think that Big Brother needs to control everybody's life because nobody can control their own life. And so this is a way for them to exercise draconian legislation that will actually promote big government. I think that's one of the things that is prompting this, but I think an even bigger influence is that of the New Age movement and pantheism. And so that's what I want to look at next. Make no mistake about it, man-made global warming is a religion. In fact, Michael Crichton, who's no friend of Christianity, has a paper that's written on his website that I would highly recommend, which I'll pass out my bibliography near the end here. But he has written an article about the religion of man-made global warming. And he's right on. It has its own cosmology. And you have the earth. You have it in a pristine condition before man comes along. It is as it should be. And then you have an anthropology where man is injected into the scene. You have hamartiology, or sin, where the great sin is making creation dirty. And then you have soteriology, which is ecology. And then you have their ecclesiology, our doctrine of the church is worship of Mother Earth or Mother Nature. And then they have their own form of eschatology. If we don't do something now, the sky is going to fall, and all of civilization as we know it's going to come to an end. Now, what is pantheism? What is it? Simply put, pantheism believes this: God is all, and all is God. And so all we see, or all that we perceive, exists as God. And I am God, you are God, your cat at home is God. Well, most cats do think they're God. You know, it's the old saying, cats have staff and dogs have masters. So, the plants are God, I am God, all is God. That is the core belief in the New Age movement. And the New Age movement isn't easy to define because it's many, many things. Some of them are very unrelated. But this is one thing that all New Agers would have in common, is this belief in pantheism, that God is all and all is God. And it's hard to define. It's just like its kissing cousin, postmodernism. In fact, postmodernism and the New Age movement go hand in hand, and that's why we see such a rise in interest in both of them together. And the New Age movement is just as subjective as the postmodern movement. And basically, it is monism, all is God. And it's combined with mysticism, and it's all blended into a nice homogeneous blend, mysticism with monism. So who is the God of pantheism? I remember one of my favorite books is The Knowledge of the Holy by A.W. Tozer. And somewhere in the beginning of the book, he's got this excellent saying. He said, "History will record that no religion can ever rise higher than its view of God." Well, if that's true, and no religion can rise higher than its view of God, what kind of view of God does the New Age movement have? Well, it's impersonal. By this, I mean that God is reduced to an impersonal force. He's not a person as we know. He doesn't have personality. It's a force. It's an energy. You've heard the term chi. That's one of the terms. You got to have good energy. The yin and the yang. People actually practice the art of feng shui, where you put your furniture in a certain configuration to create the energy fields, so that you have a more positive energy field there. That's God. And they believe, in line with that, that solid matter doesn't really exist, only energy. And so what the kind of God that the New Age movement ends up with is this. Instead of the great I am, they end up with the great it. That's it. And it's hard to define. So it's very impersonal. Secondly, it's depersonal. It's a depersonalized form of God. By that I mean he is depersonalized into some indefinable entity. Let me give you an example of that. We all know the phrase, God is love. And he is. We know that according to 1 John 4. But when you depersonalize God, you no longer say God is love, but rather you say love is God. And by doing that, what you have just done is you have limited the delimitable God. And he's reduced to love, and that's all he can be, and he can never work outside of the framework of love, because love is God. And so what they do is, you no longer have a transcendent God, a holy God who is removed from man. You have a God that's wholly immanent, meaning that he's present. He's present in all we see. He's present in us. He's everywhere. George Lucas, the creator of Star Wars, said, "There is a God force," or God, and he means force by that. "And there is both good and evil. You have a choice between the two, but the world works better if you choose good. And that's what Star Wars is based on, Buddhist mindset, some elements of Hinduism, and a few other things thrown in for good measure. You know, at the end of the day, you have good and you have evil. It would be a good thing if everybody chose good. Not everybody's going to, but that's life. And so that's their view of who God is. What are the implications of this New Age pantheism? Well, one of the implications is this. You end up with the self-realized man and cosmic consciousness. Since God is all, since all is God, that means you and I are divine. Maybe you didn't know that. And there is no original sin. And unless you're holding to absolutes, then that's the only real sin there is. But since man is divine, that means that man can now achieve his own level of salvation or redemption. And this is done through techniques for altering one's state of consciousness. Transcendental meditation. Chanting is another thing. Ecstatic dancing. Sensory deprivation. Yoga. All of these are used to have a transcendental experience, a kind of out-of-the-body experience, where you achieve oneness with the universe or with God. And that's when unity actually takes place. And so you achieve this higher state of altered consciousness. And there are techniques that they do to use that. As one theologian said, pantheism simply means, however, an identification of the world with God. The all of the world is God, and God is all. Francis Schaeffer said in his book on pollution and death, one simply does not have a creation, but only an extension of God's essence. Because everything is God, everything's an extension of who He is. Or what it is. They wouldn't even refer to Him in the personal. So, what you also end up with is a relativized reality versus realism. In other words, everything is relativized. Nothing really exists anyway at the end of the day. We just perceive. You perceive that I am standing up here and that I am teaching a seminar, but I'm not really here. I mean, this is what they believe. There is only perceived reality. Reality doesn't really exist. You could test that by going up to somebody who believes this, and you could pinch them on the leg, and you could say, you perceived that I pinched you. I didn't really pinch you. That's just a perception that you have. And so everything is relativized. They do away with absolutes. They hate absolutes. They hate certitude. And since there are no absolutes and they topple those, ultimately what happens is, they do away with individual limits. That's why you see the rise of the human potential movement. And you've got guys like Tony Robbins. South Africa has their own version of Tony Robbins. This Mike Lipkin, is that his name? And he runs around doing motivational speeches. And there are many others that do this kind of thing. And they tell people that they have unlimited potential and that they can achieve their dreams. I think probably the biggest spokesperson for this is the high priestess of the New Age movement herself, Oprah Winfrey. She is very much in the mainstream of pantheism in the New Age movement. She is no Christian. She is very much a New Ager to the hilt. She has many guests like Gary Zukav who represent that. And so they believe because human potential is unlimited and there are no barriers in this life, no boundaries, that we can actually achieve utopia, a man-made utopia where we all live and dwell in harmony and peace together. If you believe it, you can achieve it, is one of their mottos. In line with this relativized view of reality, they also teach that good and evil do not really exist, but they are only illusions of the mind. Charles Manson, who is a murderer of great note, especially in America, who killed a number of people in the late 60s, part of the hippie movement. He said this, if all is God, If God is all, evil doesn't exist. This is the principle that he lived by, and ultimately it landed him in San Quentin Penitentiary for the rest of his life. Because he believed that. So man's primary problem is not sin, but rather man's primary problem is ignorance. And so we need to just educate them. And so, you know, if only we educated the little blighters, they wouldn't run around in our schools and stab each other with their pair of scissors. And if we could just get them to sit in the lotus position for a half an hour every day and practice yoga, it would bring more peace and tranquility and harmony to the classroom. And there are some schools where they do this, especially in the United States. And I think we'll probably see it here sometime in the near future, if it's not already happening. And also, because there is no sin, and because man is the ultimate, and everything is relativized, that means there is no authority. Authority does not exist. Why? Because God is all, and all is God, therefore everything and everyone is equal. This is part of what's fueling the whole egalitarian thinking in our world today. And I'm all for every man was born equal in the sight of God. I have no problems with that. The gospel is equally applicable to people from all backgrounds, all walks of life. That's not the issue. And so what they do is they erase real distinctions and perceive, and they say those distinctions are just perceived. What that has led to is what we call the androgynous ideal. That means androgyny, andros meaning man, gune meaning woman, put it together and you end up with a neuter gender individual. That's what homosexuality is all about. That's what same-sex marriage is all about. Try to erase that distinction. They say that the gender distinctions between men and women are a social construct. Take a look in the mirror. There's a little more to it than just some social construct. There is a distinct biological difference between a man and a woman. But this is one of the things that where pantheism believes. This is where they will take you. Further on this note of relativism, no morals exist. You cannot have any morals apart from absolutes. It's impossible. That's why they don't talk about morality. They talk about values. Now, from what I can see, the values that have been put in place in the Western world today are actually valueless. They're worthless. They're useless. It's not working. You can't base your ethics on these values that the world has put in place. It just isn't working. Francis Schaeffer said, "One can never have real morals without absolutes. The only thing you end up with is arbitrariness. Arbitrary ethics, and arbitrary pragmatics. And that ultimately leads to no order, it leads to no logic, and what that means is things don't have to make sense. You can just live in a world where nothing makes sense, where everything is illogical. And when you try to argue with someone like this, there are great gaps and leaps in their logic, and it never dawns on them that they're being illogical because they're of this worldview." Well, what's the end result of all of this? Four-letter word. Chaos. I'm sorry, five-letter word. Chaos. That's where it's leading us. The Apostle Paul said in 2 Thessalonians 2:11, "And for this reason, God will send upon them a deluding influence so that they might believe what is false." That deluding influence is alive and well today, even though Paul is still looking toward a future time. What else do they believe? Well, what are the implications of this? A devalued anthropology, meaning man. They devalue man. They tear man down. Erwin Lutzer said, "To say that man is God is hardly a compliment if the same can be said for worms and thistles." And that's what happens. You see, what's actually happened here is Romans 1. They refused to worship the Creator. And they chose to worship the creation. And so God is subjugating man to the very creation that he worships. That's why in India today, 15% of the food supply is eaten by monkeys every year. Another 15% of the food supply in India is consumed by sacred cattle, and another 20% of the grain stores and corn stores are eaten by rats. In fact, in India, they have a temple to rats, and you can go there and you can have sacrament, which is a mixture of milk, rat feces, and urine. That's what happens when you become a pantheist. A great example of what happens when Western society is invaded with this Eastern thinking is this. In the United Kingdom, there is currently a court case. There was a wealthy man who died, and he had a pet chimpanzee. He died, and in his will, he left his fortune to the chimp. The problem is, the chimp is not a human, and so there's a question on the estate, and they have to take the thing to court. And they have to bequeath human rights to the chimpanzee. And the chimp even has some world-class witnesses, Jane Goodall of Gorillas in the Mist fame. It's come to that, where we are willing to give human rights to a chimpanzee and higher primates. I have a feeling that when that happens, my cats are going to be upset. And I'm afraid they're going to start a mass rolling action through our house. My question as a minister as well is, now that the gay rights community says marriage is a human rights issue, if the chimps get human rights, am I obligated to marry them? You say, that's absolutely absurd. That would have never happened. But see, that's the illogic behind this whole movement. This is where this is coming from. Ultimately, it leads to preferences for vulgarity. A.J. Conyers, who was a Christian philosopher, is quoting another man by the name of R. Patterson, and he points out that the popular expression of pantheism is manifest as a preference for vulgarity. That is, things that are common and unrefined by attention or forms, convention, morals, or manners. Simply put, it's leading to a crudening of the culture. That is why you see people walking down the street and it looks as though they were walking past a jewelry store where there was a great explosion and they experienced immediate and full body piercing all at once. They look like a human pincushion. Why does that happen? A crudening of the culture. What's promoting this? This impersonal, depersonalized view of who God is and the self-realized man who's achieved some form of cosmic consciousness? Romans 1 reminds us that whenever a man worships creation instead of the Creator, he is in subjection to it. Al Gore, the prince of man-made global warming, is a full-blown pantheist. He comes out of a liberal Southern Baptist church, but he has been imbued with New Age spirituality. And he believes that God is the sum total of all created things. And he wrote a work back in 1992, which is not as well known as The Inconvenient Truth, and it was entitled Earth in the Balance, Ecology and the Human Spirit. And in that book, he had a whole chapter entitled Environmentalism of the Spirit. And he runs around with New Agers, he quotes New Agers. I guarantee you that this book in front of me today, written by him, is a result of his New Age thinking. The question about the New Age movement is this: is it science or science fiction? And I believe, in essence, simply what's happened here is they have subjectivized the science. And in Genesis 1 and 2, creation was meant to be under man's domination, not the other way around. Man was meant to be a steward of the environment, but is not to be dominated by the environment, and that's exactly what is happening. And there are scientists who are New Agers, and they're having these cosmic experiences, and the result of that is they are wedding those mystical experiences with their science. One man who has led the charge here is from the University of California at Berkeley, and a lot of this stuff comes out of Berkeley. But Fritjof Capra wrote the book. Did you ever hear the book, The Tao of Physics? Fritjof Capra was the author of that book. He is a New Ager, he is a pantheist, and this is what he believes. This is how he practices science. There is no absolute objective reality. Objectivity is only a man-made concept. And this has led to what is called multiple vision science. And multiple vision science is mysticism plus science equals truth, if there is such a thing as truth. And they love the study of quantum mechanics. I don't know much about quantum mechanics. What I know about quantum mechanics is very dangerous. The only thing I know about quantum mechanics is this, that they study subatomic particles. And I know that subatomic particles are not as orderly. They're much more random and unpredictable than other scientific disciplines on the macro scientific level. Because of this randomness and this unpredictability of these subatomic particles, what the New Age movement has done is they have wed themselves with quantum mechanics, and they explain all of the inexplicable randomness in this quantum physics through their mysticism. And so you end up with an allegorized view of science. Elliot Miller, who is a New Age critic, said, biblical theism establishes both a basis for and limitations to scientific endeavor. The world is objectively real and was founded on rational principles capable of being discerned by rational minds. Though limits are set, because unlike naturalism, the universe is not a closed system. There is nothing scientific about theories based on non-detectable, non-physical energy systems. And so, their science is skew. What is their goal? I'm going to move on from here. I want to finish off with the scriptures. But their goal is simply this, unity without particulars. What does that mean? It just means there is a failure on their part to be able to describe, if God is all and all is God, how do you describe one particular entity of all of that? How can you emphasize one to the exclusion of the whole? Now, think of it in these terms. If unity is the goal, but you deny particulars, what happens to man in that equation? You devalue who man is. So is it any wonder that man actually becomes subjugated to the creation around him rather than being the ruler who is to subdue it? And so man gets lost in the mix, and man is the biggest loser in their ecological game because man doesn't factor. So the chimp becomes more important than the man. A friend of mine in Central California has a growing, thriving church. They've been trying to buy land. They found a wonderful 5-acre plot that they could buy. They'd saved the money. They had the money. They went to go buy it. And then the government said, well, look, we need to do an environmental impact study. When they did the environmental impact study, what they determined was there are a few California tiger salamanders there. Therefore, we have now declared all of this land a habitat for the California tiger salamander. And if you want to buy the land, what you have to do is for every acre of land you purchase for your church, you must purchase another 5 for the California tiger salamander. So now the salamander, which is in abundance in California, has its own habitat, and these people need land to build a building, and they can't. That's what happens when you worship creation more than the Creator. And that's what happens when unity rather than particulars is emphasized. Now, I'll just conclude that portion by saying I believe the science that they practice is highly subjective. Let's end on this note. I've got about 15 minutes left. How do we respond? What is our biblical response? Let me tell you first how we shouldn't respond. By climbing on the bandwagon. And sadly, there are those in the evangelical community that have done just that. There is a group called the Evangelical Climate Initiative. And basically, they have allowed the pantheists to write their creed and their charter, and then they have signed this. And there are some keynote evangelicals who have done just that. I won't mention them. I'll protect their names. I'm not interested in that so much, but they've gone over the edge. In fact, I read some articles where some of these men stated, when they were asked, "Did you read this initiative?" They said, "Well, no, I didn't really read it." "Well, then why did you sign it? I mean, would you buy a house without reading the small print before you signed the contract?" And basically what they did was signed a New Age document. We don't want to do that. So what do we need to do? We need to go back to the Word of God. And I've written all the scriptures in my text, so I won't open my Bible, but it's here in my text. The first one, we just need to be reminded of man's unique image. Genesis 1:26 through 28, "Let us make man in our image according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish and the sea and over the birds and over the sky and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. And God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them. And God said to them, 'Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. And rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over every living thing that moves on the earth.'" The point is, man has a very unique and distinct image-bearing quality that the rest of creation does not enjoy or share. And this image-bearing quality is directly related to man's stated function. And man's stated function is to rule and to subdue the creation that God has placed him in. And so who I am corresponds to why I exist. I am an image-bearing creature. Even though at post-fall, that image has been terribly marred, God has not changed his standard. The why of my existence is still in force to rule and to subdue, to have dominion over the creation. And so I share something that Bobo and BB the chimp do not share. That is why a chimp should not be allowed to have human rights. Secondly, we see man's unique assignment in Genesis 1:26-28. He says, to rule. That means to dominate, to have dominion. And it's written in the Hebrew in the imperative. It is a command. You are to rule, Adam. Secondly, you are to subdue. That means to bring things into bondage. And both verbs carry the idea of to tread down. Eugene Merrill, an Old Testament scholar, one that I really like and admire, said, "So man was created in the image of God to reign in a manner that demonstrates his lordship, his domination, by force if necessary, over all of creation." In fact, Eugene Merle goes on to say that the fact that we are to have dominion, that we are to rule, that we are to subdue, actually factors in the fall before it happens, because sometimes it means to rule by force. Not all the time, but it has that idea. It's a very strong term, or these are two strong terms. So man is to work the ground on God's behalf. We are his representatives. We see that in Genesis 2:19-20. There man was given the task of naming the animals. That means man had authority over the animals, and it also means that he had a unique relationship with them and a vested interest in them. And so that's part of ruling. That's part of subduing. Well, Genesis 3, man's ugly departure. I'm not going to go into all of that. You know the story. The serpent from the animal world exercises authority over the woman to dominate her. Wasn't it supposed to be the other way around? Precisely. And so the woman, in turn, challenges the authority of the man, pursues her own moral autonomy, while the man neglected his God-given responsibility as an image-bearing creature to exercise dominion. Paradise was lost. Relationships were fractured. Man is now alienated from God. He is alienated from his wife. He is alienated from creation. And he is even alienated from himself. So what does God do? Genesis 9, 1 through 7, we see man's uniqueness restated again. Let me just read part of this. Genesis 9, 1. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And the fear of you and the terror of you shall be on every beast of the earth and every bird of the sky and everything that creeps on the ground and all the fish of the sea, and into your hand they are given." And he goes on from there. At the end, he says, For in the image of God he made you, and as for you, be fruitful and multiply, populate the earth abundantly and multiply in it. Man's dominion capacity is now repeated after the flood. Man is still to manage and govern the animal and plant kingdom, the environment around him. In spite of the fall, he is to fulfill this task. And the way he does that is by being fruitful and multiplying so there are more men, more women to spread around the globe so that they can exercise dominion over creation. This is one of the reasons why Genesis 11, the Tower of Babel, is so wrong. Because they were failing to go out and be fruitful and multiply around the globe. Psalm 8 is another classic psalm. And deals with creation and restates much of what Genesis 1 and 2 talks about. Let me just read verse 5 there of Genesis 8. "Yet thou hast made him," meaning man, "a little lower than God, and dost cast him with glory and majesty." He's speaking of man as a king, man as being regal and noble to exercise his authority over creation, an authority that God has given to him, so that the aims and goals of creation can be realized. Verses 6 and 7 there, "Thou dost make him to rule over the works of thy hands. Thou hast put all things under his feet, the sheep and the oxen, and also the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens, and the fish of the sea, whatever passes through the paths of the seas." And so man's dominion is restated once again. The point in Psalm 8 is, man is to look up to God's glory before he looks down to creation. And in pantheism and the New Age movement, that does not happen. Well, Romans 8, I'm just doing some low flying here, reminds us that "I consider the sufferings of this present time not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed to us. For the anxious longing of creation waits eagerly with the revealing of the sons of God, for the creation was subjected to futility, not of its own will, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that creation itself will be set free from its slavery to corruption into the freedom and glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole of creation groans and suffers the pains of childbirth together until now." And he goes on, the point is, God's original intention for all of creation will be realized, but it will be realized when Jesus Christ returns at his second coming, when redemption is complete. 2 Peter 3, well, you know the story there. At the end of it all, he says, "The heavens will be destroyed with a burning, and the elements will melt with an intense heat." There will be global warming. It will not be man-made, though. It will be a God-induced global warming. And that day is coming. So, I've got a couple of minutes. Let me just give you some more practical things here. What are we supposed to do? What's a strategy for viewing the environment, for viewing global warming? Number one, under 3.7, compare the scriptures. What does the Bible tell us? It says, be discerning. "Examine everything carefully," Paul said in 1 Thessalonians 5:21. And the Proverbs talk about exercising discernment. We need to be discerning when issues like this come up. We need to scrutinize them. Secondly, consider the source. Who's promoting this? Well, we know that it's a bunch of New Age people who have a commitment to pantheism. Do we really want to sell the farm based on a bunch of mystical esoterics, however well-meaning they may be, without seriously, critically evaluating the claims and probing their motives? Thirdly, we need to consult and cross-examine credible counselors. In other words, do our homework. Don't just take the mainstream media's word for it, but do a Google search or whatever and find out what's really going on. Read both sides of the argument. Don't believe things that are sensationally written, that are filled with all kinds of exaggerated arguments. When somebody starts doing that, you should be suspicious. Next, we need to count the cost. How much is this going to cost us financially? Is it feasible to implement all that the UN wants the world to implement? From a spiritual standpoint, we need to ask the question, does God want me to spend all of my time redeeming nature? Or does God want me to spend more of my time in the redemption of souls? And then, next, we need to commit it to the Lord and ask Him. We need to remind ourselves as Christians that God did create creation, therefore we shouldn't go out and destroy it. Maybe a little conservation wouldn't be a bad thing for us. It wouldn't be not wrong to recycle and to start a compost pile and all of those things. The point is, what's the motivation? It wouldn't be wrong to scale down from a bigger car to a smaller car that's more economically viable. These are not bad things, and we need to take a cue from the world around us and say, maybe they have a point there, and maybe there are some areas where we can cut back. And then we need to do just that. Let me just give you practical example as I close here. How do we exercise good stewardship? If I cut down a tree to build a house, well, that's if you're in the northern hemisphere, then I need to replace that tree. And I shouldn't cut down trees just for the sake of cutting down trees. If I'm going to dig a mine, whether it's a coal mine or a diamond mine, I need to factor into my planning before we ever dig the first shovelful of dirt how I'm going to repair the landscape when I'm done. Because it's God's creation. We need to remember that it's His creation, we're just the stewards of it. It also means conserving instead of thoughtlessly wasting resources. We need to remind ourselves that we're to love our neighbor as ourselves, and we're to leave things in a pristine condition so that they can enjoy it to the level that we ourselves have enjoyed it. We could go on. In the end, we need to recognize that we live in a fallen world and that there will always be a noticeable degree of alienation between man and the environment, and man will not achieve utopia on his own. Francis Schaeffer said this, "More science and more technology are not going to get us out of the present ecological crisis until we find a new religion or rethink our old one." I do believe the church needs a higher degree of proactivity on this. I don't pretend to have all the answers, but let's just commit it to the Lord. Father, I thank you for the opportunity to just share a little bit of what I've gleaned over the past months, and pray that maybe some of this is helpful and that it just prompts our thinking just that much more. May you get the glory in all of this, and may we remind ourselves that this is your creation. We don't have a right to just abuse it, to squander its resources, without being proactive in the process. Father, help us to lead the way. Help us to be more thoughtful of the creation around us, that we might enjoy it because of what it tells us about you. Help us to exercise our dominion and not to be dominated by the creation. And Father, may this issue even become a springboard and a catalyst for some evangelistic endeavors with those who are zealously committed to the doctrine of pantheism. And Father, may you be glorified in that, in Christ's name. Amen.